So as she said, so I work for a research center called Policy Lab at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and something we've been looking a lot at is the impact of the Affordable Care Act on specifically on children. Again, this is my non-disclosure side. I have no relationships to disclose. So just getting started, as we all know, I'll move this. As we all know, the Affordable Care Act remade the private insurance marketplace through reforms that guarantee access to coverage, create health insurance marketplaces offering affordable coverage, and establish minimum coverage standard in the individual and small group markets. Today I'm actually going to be talking a lot about these standards, the essential health benefit classes, specifically the pediatric services one. So, these standards are known as essential health benefits, or EHBs, and they consist of 10 benefit classes. I'm not going to read them all out to you here, but you can see them on the screen. And they must be covered to some degree in all non-grandfathered health insurance plans sold on the individual and small group markets. As I said, one of the classes is pediatric services. And something to keep in mind when these EHBs are laid out, HHS actually could have established and implemented a single comprehensive preemptive essential health benefits coverage standard, but instead it chose to use a benchmark plan approach. And this approach actually permits each state to select a base benchmark plan among various commercial plans sold in the state. If a state chose not to choose a benchmark plan, then HHS could choose that plan for them. And this benchmark plan would provide a template for all other health plans to follow. And it's supposed to reflect a state's typical employer-sponsored plan. So the Essential Health Benefits Coverage Standard, it contains three principal elements. The first is that the standard provides a list of broad benefit classes, as you can see here, and the inclusion is mandatory in the plan. The standard also requires that the HHS secretary ensures that the scope of the plans subject to the standard is equal to the scope, again, of a typical employer plan. And the standard also establishes rules regarding actuarial value and cost sharing. And as you may know, and apologies if some of you, this is you definitely know this and others don't, but the actual actuarial value is expressed as metal tiers. Platinum is, you know, the average person can expect the plan to cover 90% of all costs. Gold is 80% of all costs. Silver, 70. Bronze, 60. So how does this all tie back to children? For children, the Essential Health Benefits Standard, they get all nine, the first nine, that's available to the entire enrolled population. And then they also get the 10th class of pediatric services, including oral and vision care. The regulations beyond this do not further define pediatric services. So something that happened, you know, before kind of the rollout of the ACA is that states could have chosen to include pediatric oral and vision care to adjust the plan coverage. They could have chosen either the Federal Employees Health Benefit Program or their CHIP plan to follow. They also could have adjusted their benchmark plans further by adding more required benefits, but to the extent that they chose to do so, they would be responsible for 100% of the cost of subsidizing the additional services. For all the low and moderate income families that would purchase these service, the coverage in the state's marketplace. So we actually did some research using data from the Center for Consumer Information and Insurance Oversight to examine each state's essential health benefits benchmark plan, and specifically how that related to pediatric services. And I'm going to just throw out a few caveats and limitations of our research. So we did not review the state's pediatric preventive care mandates, since coverage of pediatric services is already mandated under the ACA. And also since states essential health benefits summaries did not specify cost-sharing standards. We did not include the particulars of the cost-sharing arrangements under specific plans. And also something to keep in mind, this research I'm about to highlight used benchmark plans that were established in 2012 and served as the basis for the initial marketplace plans. So these may or may not reflect the actual plans that are in the marketplaces today. So what did our research find? We found that no state benchmark plan summary included a specific benefit category classified as pediatric services, despite the fact that those services constitute a specific category of essential health benefits. Other categories of essential health benefits were mentioned. And again, the only pediatric categories expressly mentioned were oral and vision care. So what does this look like? So I hope you can read kind of the bottom. In looking at, you know, kind of the other nine population-wide benefit categories, we tried to pick out instances in which a particular treatment or service for children was explicitly mentioned. And an example, the most frequently cited treatment mandate was for orthodontia, and 32 states did mandate that. Again, you can see 25 states specifically required coverage for treatments of congenital defects, and 24 states specifically required services for autism spectrum disorder, at least in part, and hearing aids. And then you can see, again, some other states that did, you know, how many states kind of specifically in which a particular service or treatment was explicitly mentioned. On the flip side of that, we also looked at pediatric benefits that were most frequently excluded. And again, we looked at the population-wide essential health benefits, looked for these exclusions. And we found that they typically appeared to be associated with pediatric developmental and health, mental health conditions. So for example, you can see that 13 states specifically excluded services for children with learning disabilities, and 10 states excluded speech therapy for developmental delays, stuttering, or both. So again, you can see a lot of variation in terms of inclusions and exclusions. So what do these findings mean? And before I go into that, I actually want to just mention that the absence of a specific pediatric coverage category in the benchmark plans and the presence of these limitations and exclusions involving children should not be surprising. Because again, this research is kind of looking at 2012 as the year, the benchmark plans. And before the enactment of the ACA, the typical employer plan, again, which is the starting point for these essential health benefits package, did not contain a distinct pediatric coverage standard. And also HHS essential health benefits rule from 2001, it used 2001 as the base benchmark year, and the agency's policy actually didn't appear until a special bulletin that was issued in December 2011, giving states very little time to develop a newer variation of their benchmark plan that would more specifically address the needs of children. So that's something to keep in mind. But the biggest takeaway of all of our findings is that the Affordable Care Act's pediatric essential health benefit has resulted in a state-by-state patchwork of coverage with exclusions, particularly for children with special needs and disabilities. So what can we do about this? There are several implications of our research and recommendations. So one recommendation we have specifically looks at limits and exclusions, and we suggest that pediatric treatment limits and exclusions, particularly exclusions based on mental retardation, mental disability, and other developmental conditions, should be barred. Just because a limit or an exclusion doesn't appear in a plan doesn't mean the problem is solved. Benchmark plans that are silent on this matter could actually be interpreted by insurers as permitting these exclusionary practices. These limits and exclusions also raise separate questions under the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act of 2008, which applies to all these health plans that are sold in the state marketplaces and which bar quantitative and non-quantitative treatment limits based on mental illness. It should also not be assumed, some of you may be familiar with the education system, it shouldn't be assumed that just because children are going to receive relevant services in school, maybe they qualify under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. Not all these children who get services in school need special, or who need services at home also need special education. And something else applying to these limits and exclusions is that the ACA's non-discrimination statute should further hinder any barring of pediatric, it should further hinder the barring of pediatric treatment limits and exclusions. So another recommendation we have revolves around medical necessity. The concept of medical necessity should be incorporated into the defined pediatric benefit in plans governed by the Essential Health Benefits Benchmark. In the case specifically for children, medical necessity should include not only the clinical utility and appropriateness of a covered service, but also whether that service is appropriate in the pediatric developmental health context. So an example of this is physical therapy for a pediatric patient with cerebral palsy that would allow the child to continue walking but would not cure the condition. And we believe that standards such as Medicaid's early and periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatment, EPSDT, that benefit warrants consideration. And additionally, the American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended a comprehensive pediatric benefit package, and we think that that warrants consideration when thinking about medical necessity. The next recommendation we have revolves around actuarial value in covered services, and we believe the Essential Health Benefits Standard for pediatric services should be revised to address both covered services and actuarial value. And actually, with respect to cost sharing, the HHS secretary could use their authority to set a higher actuarial value than for children than is provided for adults. And we recommend keeping with the current CHIP practice and setting an actuarial value of 90% for qualified health plans sold in the marketplaces. And actually, the HHS secretary, again, could use the pediatric benefit class to ensure that plans provide better coverage for children specifically with special needs. So HHS could even consider requiring some level of home and community care, such as personal attendant and respite care. Our final recommendation involves the CHIP benchmark, and we believe that the use of CHIP plans as a benchmark for pediatric services should be permitted. Obviously, given the significant and historically positive impact of CHIP on pediatric coverage, HHS could give states the option to use their CHIP plans to develop a pediatric services benchmark. And we could achieve many of these recommendations, actually, by having HHS review its approach to the essential health benefit regulations and choose to define essential health benefits at the federal level instead of letting states have this benchmark plan approach. Before I close, I do want to go back to the children's health insurance quickly. This is actually from an organization we work with a lot called First Focus, which found that with regards to CHIP, it's lower out-of-pocket costs and better health care, and specifically child-specific care covered for children. And there are very large implications, particularly since the future of CHIP is not entirely certain. Many children who are currently covered by CHIP could end up on these state marketplace plans. And so we're saying that right now the appropriateness of thinking about the standard for children is one of the most important issues in child health policy today, and something that we all should be thinking about. So that's it.